for this period of time by way of another metaphor. I need, for me, metaphors help me to conceptualize the program so that, and it helps me to move towards action. You know, rest assured, this is a program of action. We take action after action after action. And each, the paradox really is that in each action is the opportunity for surrender. You know, surrender for me is most certainly not a passive thing at all. Surrender is very active, but it's also detaching from outcome to the extent that I can. So by way of metaphor, I think of the way that they used to train baby elephants in the circus. Now I want to preface that by saying to those who are lovers of animals, I am as well. Okay. So please, I hope you're not distracted by the tenor of my story, of my metaphor, but it's just merely to make a point. Back in the day, they took baby elephants when they were still small, and they would tie a rope around their neck, a pretty strong rope around their neck, and attach that rope to a secure pole of some kind. And the baby elephant would do what baby elephants do. They would naturally try to walk away, and they would try to push and pull. And of course, they're stopped by the rope, and they pull and push and they twist and turn. And eventually, you know, pretty soon the baby elephant figures out that they just aren't strong enough to break free of their shackles. And so what happens? They stop resisting and they just stay where they are. And the interesting thing is that the same thing happens over and over till eventually, when the rope is put over their heads, they no longer pull and push and try to break free, because they know it's a futile effort, right? And this is why in captivity, you can walk by a circus and you can see giant elephants. At least they don't do this so much anymore, thankfully. But you'd be able to see giant elephants if you had been at a circus standing very passively with a rope. Sometimes it could be even almost like a light little string, okay? But it's enough for them to feel that around their neck. And it's not attached to anything at all. In fact, it might be held by the trainer. See, so we too can remain tethered to erroneous beliefs and false barriers, never again considering an alternative solution to true freedom. And I think it's important to, by way of metaphor, because there's many folks that are dying in this disease, right? And what if they could come to know, what true freedom is, or that it's possible? But they don't, oftentimes. They're tethered to a false belief of recovering, at best, as some sort of fight, as a daily battle for freedom, as a means of mastering their willpower and redirecting it, you know, towards better desires. And I think this was something that I fell prey to as well, and I remained shackled to those false beliefs. See, for me, there are two doors, if you will, when you arrive to the rooms of Overeaters Anonymous. And, you know, door number one is marked disease, right? And door number two is marked recovery. And, you know, the line outside door number one is much longer than the line that you'll find outside the door marked recovery. And I need to be forewarned that recovery is going to take you into uncharted territory. You know, we have to buckle up, if you will. This program is going to take courage. It's going to take grit, certainly some degree of perseverance, and it's going to take action after action after action. Not always actions that are comfortable to take. Certainly for me, putting the food down was not a step at all. That was kind of the ticket in the door to begin to embark on a process of spiritual transformation. But I had not put the food down entirely. And remember always that in the 12-step rooms, we speak in a particular language. As I said, we speak in the language of the heart. There's no, you know, as I said, no secret handshake. There's no hierarchy of governors of OA or self-anointed leaders, or no hula hoops that we have to jump through, you know, to call yourself a member. In fact, if you look to your proverbial left or you look to your right, you'll catch a glimpse of someone who got here, as I said, much in the same way that we did, which was on a losing streak of some kind, some sort of unmanageability, right? And so I'm glad you're here. And speaking of losing streaks, I want to tell you a little bit about mine. This disease, I touched on some of this before, but this disease really robbed me of my dignity. It emasculated me in so many ways. I was 100 pounds heavier. That was my physical bottom, and I was probably heavier than that, but some people come, you know, it's not as though the thinnest person in the room certainly is the healthiest. We all know that, right? But this disease stunted my emotional maturity in ways that I couldn't even imagine to grasp at the time. And although I wasn't one who wanted to get on a scale at my heaviest, like I said, I was approximately 100 pounds heavier, but I think probably a bit more than that. And this disease for me was I would characterize it today as a disease of my misunderstanding. It had such a tremendous grip on me at the time, after years, decades really, of dieting and binging and for me, bulimic compensatory exercise. I either knew what I was going to exercise through what I had already eaten or what I knew that I anticipated I was going to eat. And so at that point, each time I came out of the madness of another binge, you know, eventually I became awakened to face what the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous describes as the hideous four horsemen, right? The hideous four horsemen are mentioned on page 151 in a chapter called The Vision for You. It's a vision for you once you complete the sequential 12-step process. And I didn't understand that. I got the tools mixed up with the program of action. And so I became awakened, even in OA, to terror, bewilderment, frustration, despair. Not always, but much of the time. And they said that unhappy drinkers, unhappy eaters in our case, on this line, will hear this, will understand me completely. And I tore through relationships, intimate relationships, family, friends, coworkers, people in my community, and it made no difference. And although I looked pretty good on paper, I went all the way with my education, right? Eventually, I would either chew you up and spit you out. I would isolate from you at times. I would exhaust you emotionally. I was an equal opportunity manipulator of people. And I was a resentment producing machine. And I was the author of my divorce. I was very much the author of that divorce in some sense. And I was part-time also judge and jury and executioner. I did that on a part-time basis, although I didn't know about it and didn't get paid for it. You know, I assassinated your character in my mind, and then, you know, and then like a grenade exploding, people would get hit with shrapnel. Innocent people would get hit with shrapnel, and that was very much my life. And I missed family gatherings, I missed weddings, I missed graduations, high school reunions, never went to one of those. And in my shame, I spoke about shame, in my shame and my self-absorbed egocentric mindset, I lied about my absence to these events. And I didn't have friendship so much as I took hostages, really. It's because a friend is someone who you value and through a bond of mutual affection, right? And thus it's built on things like trust and loyalty and a give and take. Whereas a hostage describes much more in my relationships. That's the person seizes upon you and holds you close for personal fulfillment and gain. And that's what I was. I was a hostage taker, even among my nine sponsors in the first 5 years in OA, you know, posing as a friend, right? As I thought I was. And I would not have described myself that way early in OA, certainly. And I hid behind various masks. I lived very inauthentically. And just as, you know, the actors wore masks in ancient Greek theater to transform into different characters and roles, we wear masks, right? And in a metaphorical sense, it was to hide my true self, you know, my true thoughts, my true emotions. And we fool our friends, some of them. Most aren't fooled. And our colleagues and even our loved ones with the various masks that we wear. And more often than not, we avoid expressing, you know, who we really are and what we really think, because we want to fit in, because at the core is the shame and ultimately the fear of rejection. And so we wear masks to put on a certain impression or illusion, and we get into comparison, you know, with other people. And that is that, that was the root of my staying stuck in the quicksand of this disease, was that comparison. I wanted to know where you were so I can determine if I'm good, Larry, because I'm close to where you are, or I'm horrible, Larry. It was all absorbed in Larry. That was the common denominator. I didn't think too much about how I could be of service or commit to self-sacrifice for others with no expectation of a return. That was not on my mind, you know. And so, having the right job or the occupation, and you know, having the right car, the right house, we hide behind labels and titles, and in some cases, money, and our real identity is covered up by a false identity. And for me, it was very integrated with false pride. Now, I don't know if that's the case for you, and I don't, you know, but it was for me, you know. And I played, you know, the part of an actor, just like it talks about in the Big Book. And I wanted to arrange the lights and the scenery. I still want to arrange these lights here, right? Sitting behind me here, the ring of light. And our real identity, you know, back then was covered up by that, you know, that falseness. And our ego traps us in a way. The ego traps us in this artificially staged world, all out of our perceived need for acceptance. Now, I'm human. I still want acceptance. I like if you like me, or, you know, it matters. I'm human. I'll never rise above the level of a human being. You know, but today, that was, you know, looking back, that was another definition of my insanity, although I didn't see it as such. We needed to be restored to sanity. And here I was, a PhD in psychology, looking pretty good on paper, like I said, all the while dying inside. I was physically alive. I had a pulse. I appeared to be breathing, but I was basically dead on the inside. And that's perhaps worse than the last breath death that we're all going to take. To be physically alive, can you relate? To be physically alive, but devoid of anything resembling life. And that's how I pursued my life. And here's something that took me a long time to understand. And I think it's crucial. That is that the sequence, the order of the 12 steps, doing the steps in order, following the instructions precisely, not perfectly, with entire abstinence. What is entire abstinence? Well, we need to find that out. Doing the steps quickly doesn't mean that we're not going to do them thoroughly, but that if I did them quickly and it forced me to trust in a process, a spiritual process of transformation, right? That would produce an effective spiritual awakening. And effective means sustainable. It's not wishy-washy. It's sustainable. You know, because guess what? Today, you know, I'm carrying a message. You're carrying a message. We all carry a message. We may not articulate it, but we are a message. You know, we're carrying a message whether we like to or not. And so, you know, I want to be able to carry a message and be brought into alignment, deeper, more profound alignment with the higher power of my own understanding, so that I could be of maximum service to you, that I could be helpful to the people around me. And so here's a shorthand for the 12 steps that someone gave me years ago that proved to be very helpful. I might have alluded to it in the first hour, I can't remember. But this shorthand helped me to understand the sequence, the order of the steps. And it's very simple. Steps 1, 2, and 3 get me right with God. If you don't like the word God, steps 1, 2, and 3 build the foundation to get you right with this sense of a higher power, something greater than you. Steps 1, 2, and 3 get you right with God. Steps 4 through 7 help to get me right with myself. 4 through 7 get me right with myself. Steps 8 and 9 get me right with others. And steps 10, 11, and 12 keep me right with God, with myself, and with others. See, this isn't a hobby for me today. This is a way of life. 1, 2, and 3, because someone will ask, 1, 2, and 3 get me right with my higher power. 4 through 7 get me right with myself. 8 and 9 get me right with others. And then 10, 11, and 12 keep me right with my higher power, with myself, and with you, with others. And you know, step one, we admitted that we were powerless over alcohol, we were powerless over food, that our lives had become unmanageable. You know, when I embark on step one, I need to gain clarity on three specific critical concepts, three concepts that are critical in my powerlessness. The first one is this alcoholic mind, this compulsive overeating mind. What is it? And do I have this problem? And what's wrong with me? And is what's wrong with me alcoholism or compulsive overeating? And how would I know? And the second concept is what is the solution to that problem? If I realize I have the problem, and if I diagnose myself as having that problem, what's the solution to my problem? And then the third critical concept is, how do I bring that solution to light? In other words, how do I make that solution happen with God's help? Which is, as we know, about action, right? We have to be in the arena taking action after action after action. Now, when I say have to, no, you don't. You can sit and watch the people in the arena, as I did. And you can wait for time served or some sort of pixie dust recovery or some sort of magic wand recovery, as I did. And I will tell you in my own experience with love and kindness, I'll tell you that never happened for me. And if it happens for you, beautiful, but it just didn't happen for me. I had to be in the arena. And those are the three things that you're gonna need to know for recovery. And quite frankly, those are the three things anybody in the world is gonna need to solve any problem. What's the problem? What's the solution to my problem? And how am I going to bring this solution to light? And now, because there's been an unbelievable watering down of our basic message over the course of time in AA and OA has been in existence, there has leaked into our rooms an immense amount of misinformation around these three core concepts. You know, what your problem is, what the solution to your problem is, and how you're going to bring that solution to light. And that misinformation, in my opinion, that erroneous information, considering that we're dealing, let's be honest, with a life and death errand here, a life and death disease when it comes to compulsive eating and other types of addictions, that misinformation does more than just serve as a detriment to you. It may serve and assist in killing you. In other words, it's deadly information. And if that's harsh, you know, I've seen people die in this disease, perhaps you have as well. So I'm willing to have the courage to speak, say what I mean and not say it mean, hopefully, but to be firm and convicted in what's happened to me, my experience in this program. Therefore, it's critical that we understand the truth about our problem. What are the facts? And I want to be clear when I say the facts. I'm not talking about Larry's opinion. I mean, I'll offer you a few opinions along the way, and you can distinguish what you think of me and how much stock you put into my opinions and what you want to do with those opinions. But here's the thing about opinions in the 12-step rooms. They're opinions. Not only are they opinions, but they're the opinions of drunks and compulsive overeaters and addicts, right? Whom I love, by the way. Now, I'm not suggesting that drunks and compulsive overeaters don't have decent opinions. I suspect, like I said, I may have some decent opinions, and I'm sure you do as well. And catch me out in the parking lot after the meeting, you know, if you will, and I'll be glad to share some of my opinions. But I can assure you that my opinions will not get you well. Nobody's opinions will get you well. And frankly, the opinions of addicts and compulsive eaters are not particularly hard to come by, right? I mean, just venture over to the nearest bar or bakery or, you know, your family's home, extended family. Just venture over there and prior to COVID anyway, right? You can't go over, so, you know, have your mask on. But you'll get all the opinions you ever wanted, right? And see, the idea of the rooms is not for you to get people's opinions. Now, with that said, you'll find OA littered with people, beautiful, well-intentioned, lovely, smart people. I'm not being patronizing. I really mean this. who will give you opinion and frame them, those opinions, as fact. And that's going to be very dangerous to someone who's in early recovery. Very dangerous. And by way of contrast, I'd like to take a stroll with you. Let's take a stroll. For our purposes, say 1947. Okay. And you walk into an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. Remember, that's the, we're OA, but you know, built upon the foundation as all 12-step programs were. It started with AA. So let's go back to 1947. I was only 15 at the time, not really. So you walk into an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting in 1947, you're sick and suffering, you're dying from untreated alcoholism, and you stroll in for the first time. And here's basically what you could have expected to happen. You would have been welcomed upon entering. You would have been embraced upon entering, very likely. You would have been introduced to all the members of the respective group. And then you know what they would have done? They would have assigned you what's called a sharing partner. Sharing partner, so you would have been linked up with somebody. A sharing partner, by the way, of course, means the exact same thing as sponsor, right? And we didn't have that terminology back then, as far as I have studied. But this whole notion of searching out for somebody didn't exist back then. So they'd link you up with the sharing partner. And that sharing partner would have sat you down and essentially would have told you the following. They would have said, I'm going to be your advocate over the course of the next four weeks. And tonight, or this morning, you're going to find out what's wrong with you in step one. And then you're going to find out this afternoon, what the solution to what is wrong with you in step two. And then you're going to make an affirmative declaration in step three, which means something you say out loud, based on your understanding of the problem and the solution to your problem, that you're ready to get to work. That's all you're going to do. Step three, all you're going to do is make an affirmative declaration that you're ready to get on with the work. This idea of conceptualizing and wallowing in step three and, you know, understanding God, and I don't even know who I am, let alone God is, when I get to step three, suffering in my disease, that didn't exist then. You're just going to make an affirmative declaration in step three that you're, the way you're going to turn your will and your life over to this higher power that you may or may not believe in is by getting on with the work. That's how they did it, right? And then next week, the person would tell you, your sharing partner would tell you, assuming you come back, and you may not, we're going to go over steps four and five. And we'll talk about a searching and fearless moral inventory. I'll help you with that. The following week, you'll complete your inventory. And then you and I are going to sit down and you'll complete your fifth step with me. You'll give that away to me. And when you come back after that, we'll go over step six, seven, eight, nine, and you'll begin your eighth step list, where we'll begin. I'll help you with that. And you'll begin doing your nine-step amends, which is going to take a little bit of time. And upon completion of your nine-step amends, guess what? You're going to become a recovered compulsive overeater. Remember, we talked about recovered, not cured, but the obsession will be lifted. And at that point, of course, you'll begin working steps 10, 11, and 12 for a lifetime, enabling you to grow and maintenance what you've been so graciously given, by being brought into alignment with this higher power of your own understanding. And now, at that point, guess what? You become a sharing partner for another suffering alcoholic. Now, that is unequivocally the way things were done for the first, say, quarter of a century in Alcoholics Anonymous, when they were in existence. And the rates of recovery were quite good. Not perfect, but they were pretty good. Now let's fast forward to November of 2020. You're sick and suffering. You're a sick and suffering compulsive overeater, and you enter the rooms of OA as I did years ago. Now you may or may not be welcomed upon entering. Now in Tucson, you're always welcomed upon entering, but other places, I've been around the country, other places you may not be welcome, but in Tucson you'll be welcome. But you may or may not be welcome when you enter. They may recognize you're a newcomer, they may not. Now, they may talk about the 12 steps. They may not talk about the 12 steps at all, which is the program of recovery. And considering that topic and discussion meetings in OA, i.e. food and dieting and those types of things, tend to outweigh literature meetings like Big Book Studies and OA literature meetings by about 7 to 1. That's an estimate from World Service. Since that's the case, chances are you may not hear about the program of action at all. Now, I love OA, but let's face it, we can't talk about a 50% rate of recovery. We can't talk about a 25% rate of recovery, can we? We're lucky if 5 out of 100 that enter the rooms of OA recover, get to this recovered state of being, where they're not holding their breath underwater anymore. And then their lives begin to continue to change and they're brought into deeper, profound alignment with their higher power. 5% would be a stretch, I think. See, I've heard it said, we come by the hundreds and we leave by the 99s, except in Tucson. Now, in OA, I have to tell you, we are so loving and nurturing, right? And we'll hold your hand and we'll gently walk with you to the very best of our intentions, and we'll walk with you to your grave, you know? And we'll love you as you die from this disease. And I've seen people die from this disease in my years here. And as nurturing and as kind as we are, we oftentimes unintentionally are killing more people than we're saving. And it's troubling. It's very troubling indeed. Which is a good segue into step one. You know, what is helpful with step one is to concentrate on the text of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. At least it was for me. That doesn't mean that I don't read OA literature. Of course I do. It helps me to identify in. It helps illuminate and bring alive what this recovery process is. As I mentioned, Roseanne was brilliant, quite in the same way that years before Bill W. and Dr. Bob and the early pioneers were brilliant, I think. And I think what they did, in my opinion, was divine in nature. I think what they published and the message they carried was sacred and divine in nature. That's what I believe. I'm not here to convince you of that, but that's what I've come to believe. And I think, as I say, you know, the doctor's opinion is an excellent place to start in understanding the twofold nature of the disease. I spoke a little bit about this, because if I don't understand my problem, you know, the rest of the instructions in the Big Book are not going to make a whole lot of sense to me, even though I'm sure you have a high IQ, you read a lot, you absorb all those things. The thing is that I wouldn't have the clarity of mind to if I don't understand my problem. Like, for example, when I thought my problem was not both the abnormal physical reaction and the twist of the mind, when I didn't know that the root of my problem was selfishness, was self-centeredness or self-absorption, even in the midst of my charitable nature, when I didn't understand that, my mind went to my problem is the sexual and physical abuse that I experienced as a child. Because if you had that type of trauma, of course you'd eat. And I'm not minimizing that. And I'm not saying that can't manifest in a myriad of ways for people. So I'm not, you know, I have complete empathy for people with that. But that is not, as I'd said earlier, what makes me a compulsive overeater. What makes me a compulsive overeater is merely that I have both the abnormal physical reaction and I have the mental twist that drives me back. So I cannot stop from starting. And once I start, I cannot stop. So I'm kind of in a pickle there, right? I'm probably eating pickles, you know, not the healthy kind either. I'm really in a pickle there. I'm really screwed in many ways because I don't have the needed power. See, it's like, I wish I could show you in this room, in your room where you are, you have an electrical outlet and I have one, and I'm not gonna take my phone off the thing here, but you can take a look at the electrical outlet in your room and we see it, I see it, and I'm not a very handy guy and I'm certainly not an electrician. And I see that, I know that if I plug in my appliance, my laptop, what have you, that power flows through generally, right? 99.99% of the time, unless you got a storm coming in or something, occasionally it's out for a little bit, you know, but I know, and I don't understand the red from the white, from the black, from the blue. I don't know. I really don't know truthfully how electricity works, but I trust in it. It works for me and I don't need to know how it works. I just know, but And I've had an awareness of the electrical outlets in my rooms, whatever room I was in, for many years, as you have, right? And without a complete understanding. But I knew that if I wasn't plugged in, of course the power is not going to flow. Now, metaphorically speaking, that's the same with programs. See, these 12 steps produce an essential, effective psychic change. Are you more comfortable calling it a personality change? Are you more comfortable calling it a spiritual awakening? Does it really matter if it comes on, you know, quickly, like a light switch, suddenly, or if it comes on more slowly, is it, you know, like a dimmer switch? Does it really matter? You know, but I'll tell you this, that I needed to understand my problem. And because as long as I saw my problem as food and my traumatic past, I would continue to search for a solution that wasn't spiritual in nature. Really? Spiritual nature? I got to tell you, I did not come to Overeaters Anonymous for certain things. One of them was to have a spiritual awakening. That is not, I don't know about you, but that is not what got me to my first meeting. My first meeting, I was 100 pounds heavier. My life was an absolute mess. I was full of fear and anxiety and frustration. And I thought, what the heck, I'll try this. That's how many of us arrive here. And we crawl into the rooms. And it takes us a while. It's very frustrating. And quite frankly, we hear information, you know, all sorts of information. And sometimes, again, not in Tucson, but in other places in this country, that they you know, the person leading the meeting is beautiful and lovely and a wonderful, compassionate person, and yet they still may be drunk. They still may be drunk, but they've kept the weight off. And that you come in there and they tell you to put the plug in the jug, you know, put the food down. Now, they never worked the steps, so they're not going to advocate for working the steps. Maybe they did like what I did, is they dabbled in the steps and they darted around and the program told us, take what you want and leave the rest, like a salad bar. You know, I'm going into the salad bar. You tell me to take what I want and leave the rest. I'm leaving a lot of it and I'm taking the good stuff that I like. Unfortunately, there is, in the context of program, you know, there's some fundamental things. There's two legs that hold up this program. The first one is the practical program of action, and the other one is fellowship. And they both inform each other and they're both critical, but they are not the same thing. And nobody was telling me that early on. Fellowship, the tools, critical, the handrails, the telephone, the literature, the sponsorship, the food plan, all that stuff, fellowship, service, beautiful, lovely, necessary. They're the handrails that we use while we work the practical program of action. What is the practical program of action? The 12 steps. And somehow the message got lost in there for me. And I began to work out primarily a program of tools because I didn't know any better. And all I knew was I kept holding my breath underwater and I kept sort of dieting with group support. And frankly, everyone else around me was doing the same thing, it seemed to me. And some of them were in thin bodies and some of them spoke with great authority and talked about, Larry, I've been in this program for 5 billion years. And I got to tell you, buddy, you come here and you put the plug in the jug. You put the food down. Take the cotton out of your ears and put it in your mouth. Be quiet. Sit there. Listen. Keep coming back. Meet Larry, meeting makers make it. That's not true. That's not true. Not for me. Now, let me be clear. When I began to work and when others began to work the practical program of action found in the 12 steps, trusting in the process, working the steps as only a human being can, imperfectly, taking action after action after action, actions that are very uncomfortable, putting their food down entirely. If they're not sure what their alcoholic food substances are, then they need to, you know, there's some complexity there. They need to learn, you know, what those are and begin to put those down entirely before they embark on the practical program of action found in the 12 steps. Because for me, otherwise, I'm working a program lacking integrity. I'm trying to game the system. I'm trying to game the system. I'm trying to get an effect, you know, through the steps. I want to feel better first. And then, sure, I'll become a better person and I'll bring in this higher power and, you know, and kumbaya, right? But that's not how this program was designed to be worked. The program was designed to be worked. If you look at early AA, they worked it rather quickly. Have you ever looked at, have you ever read Dr. Bob's Nightmare? How quickly, now you say, oh, but that was years ago. This was, I mean, you know, this is, they were misogynistic. I don't know what that means, but they didn't treat women well. And they did all, and they spoke in ways that we don't speak to now. And they were flawed, and so are we. It was just a different time. But my point is look how quickly Dr. Bob began to work the steps. Now, we didn't even have 12 steps. They had the six tenets of the Oxford Group movement. You know, they had the idea of powerlessness, and they had the idea of a reliance upon some power greater than themselves. And then they had an idea of a moral inventory, they called it, right? And then they had the idea of making restitution for harms done, very much like our amends. And then they had the idea of service and self-sacrifice for others, and an alignment with a higher power, a way to align through prayer and meditation for a lifetime. But service and self-sacrifice, that's how Ebbie Thatcher showed up at Bill's door, if you're a student of history in AA, because he had to carry the message if he wanted to keep it. And then we do this not as a hobby, but as a way of life, right? So I need to understand what I'm up against, and you'll find that in the doctor's opinion, right? And so, you know, when I look at this, it's a series of surrenders. The program came down to a series of surrenders. A series of surrenders would bring about a drastic change in one's ego. We have this uncanny ability as humans to remain forever self-absorbed, even though we're good people, we mean well, we have good intentions. And yet for me, when I was smashing windshields and tearing up relationships and all those things and eating myself to death, you know, I could also occasionally be a very charitable, well-intentioned person. You know, even a broken clock is right twice, and I could be a decent human being. But I rest assured, my ego needed to be smashed, as the big book says. It needed to be right-sized. Some areas I needed to be brought up. Some areas I needed to be brought down to be one among many. And I was very self-absorbed. And so the 12 steps calls upon us to wave the white flag. Have you waved the white flag? I didn't. Because eventually when you do wave the white flag, it produces a phenomenon where we're brought into congruence with the will of this power greater than us. You know, look at it like this. The first surrender is to your pride when we admit we have a problem. Mind you haven't even taken step one yet, but just getting into the rooms is our first surrender, right? The next surrender might be, you know, taken by choosing to put the food down entirely, and or the behaviors. You know, because I know there are restrictors and anorexics and bulimics that are also compulsive readers. And the same thing there. They get, you know, this is the way I describe it. When I pick up an Oreo cookie, my desire for more doesn't become satisfied. It becomes magnified. It becomes intensified, right? And then the mental twist drives me back. So I can't stop from starting, and I can't stop once I've started. Now, with a compulsive overeater who's an anorexic bulimic, for example, I'm no expert, but along with compulsive overeating, there's something about, excuse me, I hope you're not eating, about regurgitating that brings them a sense, they're chasing an effect that brings them a sense of ease and comfort. Now, if you don't understand that, that's okay. I'm not someone who does that, but rest assured that's true. They engage in behaviors that give them a sense of control, ease and comfort in the midst of the calamities of life and the things that are out of control. And so it does the same thing for them physiologically that an Oreo cookie does for me. Those behaviors bring them a sense of ease and comfort, and they will continue to pursue that over and over again. And unless they can have an entire psychic change, there's very little hope of their recovery, just like me. But on the other hand, if they work the steps, you'll be surprised at the transformation. I know people on this line and throughout the country, throughout the world, really, that have those types of ancillary behaviors that are, that they can't believe it. they're as amazed and baffled that I can, that I have not found it necessary to pick up any, you know, processed sugar and flour for many years, along with certain combinations of fats. And I don't talk about food, so I'm not going to be taking questions on food, not because I want to avoid it, but just because, you know, like I've never eaten one apple and wanted 20 more when I got done, but maybe you have. The point is that we can diagnose ourselves, we can get honest, and we can get with a proper nutritionist who understands the nature of our disease. That's important. A nutritionist, a doctor that understands the nature of our disease is important, right? So that surrender is putting the food down. And a surrender is not a temporary thing at all, right? It's permanent. It's unconditional. You know, I can assure you that when an army, you know, of some country surrenders in history, they relinquish complete control. There's no such thing as a temporary waving of the white flag. There's no such thing as a conditional waving of the white flag, right? There's no such thing. We have to trust in the process. What process? The tools? No, the tools are the handrails. Very important. You must use the tools. They will provide you love and support in the fellowship as you're uncomfortable. They're a safety net as you're uncomfortable, because you haven't crossed the bridge to freedom where the twist of the mind is eradicated. You haven't been brought into complete alignment with the higher power of your own understanding yet. Of course you're uncomfortable. Again, as my daughter, who's going to be 25, used to say years ago, duh, right? Duh, Dad. So are we trusting in the 12 steps? Because when navigated properly, it's going to give us access to power, that outlet. We're going to be plugged into that outlet now. Duh, right? And when that happens, then the promises begin to unfold. And half measures of surrender are not going to avail a whole lot. In fact, the big book says they avail you nothing, right? And I'm going to wrap up so we can go to more questions here, but I'd be remiss, I think that means negligent, if I didn't convey to you some of the problems in the fellowship. I say this again because, you know, out of my love and passion for our fellowship, and so that this thing can be around. Don't we want this thing of ours to be around? I hate to sound like the mafia. This thing of ours to be around 100 years from now for your grandchildren and great-grandchildren, if they need it. God forbid if they need it, right? So the purpose of the big book of the Alcoholics Anonymous is stated very emphatically in the foreword to the first edition. Again, I read it earlier, but I'm going to read it again. We of Alcoholics Anonymous are many thousands of men and women who have what? Recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. See, the obsession was eradicated. They've recovered. Now they're going to have to remain in fit spiritual condition, right? That's the rub. To show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of the book. It is the very reason the book was published in 1939, was to enable people like us to do what? To recover from a seemingly hopeless state of mind. You know, the twist of the obsessed mind and body, the allergy of the body, the abnormal reaction. So the authors are not going to be vague. They're not going to be ambiguous about what you have to do in order to gain access to power. And all the while, I thought I needed the right food plan. I needed the right partner. I needed the right psychologist to help me process my emotions around the sexual abuse and the physical abuse at an age that no one should go through those things, right? And I'm not trying to, you know, sensationalize it. I'm just saying that, if that was my problem, I am going to find the solution. My rational mind says I will chase after the solution to that, but that wasn't my problem. The food was just numbing me out as an anesthetic. I needed access to power, and yet somehow, until I experienced that unequivocally, I would continue to chase after other solutions. And I would use this as a fallback kind of thing. And it was a good group therapy thing, right? So here's a few things that I've noticed. Maybe you have as well. Many of our OA meetings are, as I said, being run by people who are still drunk on food. You know, the people who have not put the food down entirely. You know, we're often told to work a program of tools rather than a program of action. You know, if my sponsor told me to call him at 6:02 a.m. every morning, I'm on that phone dialing at 6:01. And I thought that by doing, being a good boy, you know, that that was surely the pixie dust is going to come, the karma, the whatever. And that wasn't true for me, right? We take too long, I think, to work through the steps. If we actually complete the steps, sometimes too, we rest on our laurels. We don't sponsor. We treat it like an 11-step program. We're afraid to sponsor. Now, I've heard it said, perhaps you have, I wouldn't be afraid of sponsoring. I'd be afraid not to sponsor, right? So, you know, I'd like to take a quick break for some questions, if there are some, and then we can wrap up with living life on life's terms a little bit, if that's okay. Is that all right, Becky? Or
yes, Karen? That's perfect.
Okay. Maybe there'll be none, but who knows?
Does anyone have any questions? Raise your hand in the chat. *9 also raises your hand.
If not, we can move on.
Okay. Well, thank you, Larry. This has been so great. We do have Michael. Go ahead.
Hey, Michael here, compulsive overeater. Appreciate that, Larry. That's not an approach that we're used to. I should speak for myself. That I'm used to, having been down here in the Tucson area for 4 years. It gives me a lot to think about, and I suspect that it took something to deliver that message today, but. On the one hand, it made me a little uncomfortable, but on the other hand, I know that when I'm uncomfortable, it's often because my complacency is being disturbed, and that's often a good thing. But I just wanted to say it gives me a lot to think about. I appreciate your service and your commitment to making this program effective, and again, lots to think about. Thank you very much.
Yeah, if I could comment, Michael, on your comment there. And I so appreciate it. Thanks for saying that. You know, one of the things for me that comes to mind, we are a big tent in Overeaters Anonymous, and AA was a big tent, and OA is a big tent. And I think there's a resurgence, there's a renaissance. You know, it's one of the silver linings that I've seen. Perhaps you have too, Michael, with COVID, which has not been a nice thing, but clearly, much more opportunity for people to hear messages of depth and weight. And there's no one message. And I'm giving my experience, strength, and hope around what worked for me. I have my sweetheart lives in Littleton, Colorado, and my sweetheart has good recovery. You know, she's a good person. She has spiritual connection. She has not found it necessary to compulsively overeat. And we've talked about it. I advocate for working the steps relatively quickly because that was my experience. It was kind of like they asked Ernest Hemingway years ago. They said they're talking about his bankruptcy, his literal financial bankruptcy. And they said, did you notice it coming on? He said, we thought about it. He said, yeah, first slowly and then suddenly, right? First slowly and then suddenly. And so for me, I spent 5 years kind of languishing in the rooms, and they're beautiful people that are still friends today. And I'm no guru, and I have no, you know, we have no monopoly on anything here, right? But I just share this. And so my sweetheart, she, you know, talks about meeting people where they are, and some people need to take longer, and they can get whatever it takes for people to get to this place. I've just seen, you know, people that have died, as perhaps you have, Michael, and of this disease, although on the death certificate, it doesn't read compulsive overeater, you know, it reads other things. And so that drives my passion for delivering kind of a strong message about the, you know, the speed, but in no way do I suggest there's only one way to do this, or, I mean, that boy, that would be the epitome of lacking humility and all those things. But so I really appreciate your comments on that.
Thank you. It looks like we have Carolyn as well. Go ahead, Carolyn. You're on mute. There you go.
There I am. Your approach is certainly different. You know, I still feel, and this is an opinion, that always different than AA, and because there's just a different set of whatever things within the person, and I just, you know, when I sponsor, if I had been that, I do believe people should be welcomed, and we are weak on that when we have a newcomer. But to go as fast as you're going, I think people would run away. And I guess I'm like your fiance. I feel a more gentle, slow approach. But how did you, are you coming to this just from your own experience, or what other things?
Yeah, that's a great question. Based on my own experience, but there is a large contingent of people that I have found. I've had the privilege of encountering people through conventions, and some that I spoke with, but I didn't speak for a long, long period of time, that have been advocating for this message of kind of a back to basics kind of approach, working through it quickly, which requires trusting in a spiritual process. As a psychologist, it goes against every grain of me, because I come from a psychoanalytic kind of thing, which essentially means, you know, I mean, it means many things, but one of the things it means is, you know, we process things and we peel away the layers of the onion and we get to the core of things, and we're very nurturing and we want to validate people and make them feel comfortable and trusting and build an alliance of trust, right? And I think that's true in OA. Here's the problem, though, for me. The problem is, for example, just one example. I've known priests, two preachers, and a pastor, and one nun that came into OA, and they had lovely spirituality. They had their theological, religious practices, and they were helping people. And they were doing, you know, they were just, I loved talking to them and I knew them. And, and I've also known some psychologists and a couple of psychiatrists that have come into program. That takes a lot of courage. You won't find many. There's just too much synthetic knowledge. I don't see a lot of people that, they'll drive people to the rooms of OA, but they won't participate in it, is my experience and my observation. Now, the reason I bring that up with the speed at which requires trust in a power that's greater than Larry, greater than ourselves, is because the one common denominator with the people I mentioned is a fact. The one common denominator is they're all dead, every single one of them. And that's the truth. And they died of this disease. Now, we're all gonna die. I accept that, you know, we're gonna have that last breath, death and so forth, but I don't wanna die of this disease. Now, if that sounds harsh and all that, because the psychologist in me, if I'm dealing in the secular world and, you know, with the perceptive lens that they have and what their expectations are and mine, you know, let's work through relational issues. Let's take maybe it's a cognitive behavioral approach, and all these are outside issues, but just to say that, you know, I believe in some of that here, but I believe that people, I don't bring about their transformation as a carrier of the message or a Sherpa that guides them through the steps. I personally believe in my experience and my observation, which I think is consistent with what the core literature speaks about, is what effectuates the change is the higher power. Now, it says God either is or God isn't, and what's my choice to be? By the way, I'm not a religious person. I'm not a theological person. At best, I'm an agnostic. And I, for people that are, that's wonderful. That for atheists, I've seen atheists recover. But at some point, they had to be open to the ever slight possibility that there's a power, not of themselves, that could restore them to sanity. That is what step two is referring to. So you know, my experience was, until this happened to me experientially, I was very resistant to any message that was outside of my, the perceptive lens in which I saw the world, you know? So again, that being said, there's no have to's, there's no have to's and all that. And I'm not on the line to disturb anybody. I didn't wake up this morning to do that. You know, I'd love for people to validate me and like me and so forth. But I just, because I know that this is a cunning, baffling, powerful, deadly disease, not for everybody. Some can just come and, you know, and not everyone in the rooms are compulsive overeaters. They might not have both the allergy of, and the obsession. My daughter has a peanut allergy. It's deadly to her. The physical manifestation of her peanut allergy is throat constriction. In other words, her throat closes up to the size of a pinhole and she can die. It's true. And then she's treated with an EpiPen, right? And then of course you have to take her to the hospital so they can observe, and she's fine. When that's happened accidentally, she's fine. Now here's the thing. Once my daughter's treated and she says, doctor, let's say she says this, doctor, that was terrible, this almost dying thing. I don't wanna go through that. What do I do? And the doctor, she turns to her and she says, Beth, yeah, I absolutely have a solution. Don't eat peanuts. Now here's the thing, she doesn't ever. She doesn't have to go to Peanuts Anonymous to build up and work through issues so that she won't pick up the peanuts. See, because Beth only has one aspect of two. She only has an abnormal physical reaction to peanuts. Can you imagine if she had the twist of the mind that drove her back to the very thing that was killing her? And that's why she doesn't ever have to worry about peanuts flying off the shelf down her gullet. She doesn't want them. See, today, by these steps and the grace of my higher power, I have neutrality over food, and I'm not the only one. You know, it might be the first time you're hearing it, but there's lots and lots of people that are advocating this message. So that's all on that question. But thanks for the question. It's a great question.
All right. Next, we have Dale Ann, and then Paula T and Deb B.
I think I'm unmuted. I'm Dale Ann. I am here by rights. I'm a compulsive eater. And I came in the back door in the sense that I belong to three other programs. And when I recognized that diet and exercise wasn't helping my deadly disease, my AA sponsor said, put on your shoes, let's go to an OA meeting. And as I say, I'm in three other programs, and not to talk about them too much, but AA was one of them. And my sponsor always answered the phone with, what step are you on? And though I certainly wasn't a great sponsee, I come from that. And I often complain, why are we talking about AA in OA? I get it. It is substance abuse. My eating is substance abuse. And it's a cunning, baffling disease. I heard two legs of the program, action and fellowship. And I used to come in the back of a meeting and leave without talking to anybody. And I had to learn that I needed the other people in the room. I always say I am a step sponsor. I'm not a food sponsor, I'm a step sponsor. And so I'm not surprised at all by this. I'm surprised by, what do you mean this is a different idea? But then I come from a different background. And I say I'm in three other programs, and the solution in all of those programs is the same, action and fellowship. And so thank you again. I keep thanking you.
Yeah, thank you. I want to just comment on that because I didn't answer the other portion of the previous person's question. So I go to AA as well, and we do have a singleness of purpose, and I know the traditions, and so I won't, you know, focus too much on that, but only to say that in all the years that I've gone to AA meetings, they have a drinking plan. Now, they don't call it a drinking plan, I see them. It's crazy. They drink, some of them drink coffee. It's the weirdest thing. Some drink water. I see them. They drink soda. They drink juice. I see them drink all sorts of things. In fact, if they didn't drink anything, they die most assuredly faster than I would if I didn't eat anything, right? They just don't call it that. But here's something they don't drink, not even any, alcohol, right? Now, I understand the complexity of figuring out what is my alcoholic food substance that triggers the craving. There's more complexity to that. I have empathy, sympathy for people, including myself, to figure that out. Okay, but once I do and I get honest about the underlying substance that is the celebrity in the room, you know, it's the thing that, you know, normal people eat, and when they eat even something, you know, exciting, excuse me for a second, I'm getting a call that's coming in, so I'm gonna get rid of that. Even when they eat something exciting, at some point, their desire for more gets satisfied, and then they become disinterested in the food. That's why they could, you know, these people that they can put their fork down to tell you a story that's important to them. Who does that? I didn't understand how they did that. You know, because they got a hamburger and French fries or a piece of cake or whatever it is in front of them, and they're putting their fork down to tell me a story. All the while, I'm just seeing the food. That was the celebrity in the room. Right. And that's the same to some extent for an alcoholic. That was always, the people were secondary. I wish that wasn't the case, but that was. I was jonesing for more of the same. So I actually today see more similarities through addiction, even if it's addiction and obsession for other things, behaviors and substances. I see a physiological change. You know, and I see a twist of the mind that drives them back to doing more of the same. We need to have access to power to be brought into alignment with a higher power. And that's never changed. Although, like I said, I'm all for people that want to come into this program. The big book says anyone at all, I'm paraphrasing, anyone at all can benefit from this, whether you're a compulsive overeater, an alcoholic or not. But I'll tell you this, if you're not a true compulsive overeater, and I say this with love, really, I can't have you sponsor me because you might tell me, if you sponsor me, you might tell me, Larry, here's what you do. Because this is what I did. You come into the meetings, meeting makers make it, you put your food down and you just keep coming. And I'd be dead today if that was the... Now it worked for them because maybe they didn't have both the allergy and the obsession. Maybe they just had a divorce and all manner of unmanageability in their life, but they didn't have the twofold nature of the disease. So they were able to come in, align themselves with the group, hear good messages of strength, and just put the food down from day one and lose the weight or gain the weight, whatever they needed to do, and live happily ever after. And they're welcome here, because they have a desire to stop eating compulsively. It's just, if they sponsor someone like me, I'll die. Because, and if that sounds a bit melodramatic, sorry, it's just the truth. I was on my way to a suicide on the layaway plan kind of death, right? So anyways, thanks for the comments. We move on to the next question.
Yes. We have Deb, or actually we have Paula T, Deb B, and Jen A.
Okay.
So go ahead, Paula.
Hi, my name is Paula and I'm a compulsive overeater.
Hi, Paula.
I was wondering, Larry, thank you so much for your share. That was really amazing. And I got a lot out of it. But I was wondering, how do you tell if a food is a red light food? I'm having a really hard time determining that. So do you have any markers that you use?
Yeah, well, again, I it's a great question, and I will definitely answer it as best I can. I try not to talk about food so much because, I mean, gosh, that's why we come here, right? But just because I think there's a lot of comparison and controversy about what is food, you know, or this or that, and kind of a one size fits all type of deal. I just merely follow what the doctor's opinion talks about. The alcohol must be down in order for us to benefit from this spiritual program of action, transformation. Okay, so now to your question. You know, for me, for some people, it does help them to go through, like Jen will speak in a moment. That's my sweetheart, by the way. She may have a question, or I'd love to hear her commentary. But she talks about going through a food history from the very beginning. And she could do a better job explaining it. But like, I had to go through a food history. What were the foods? Not the substances at this point. We want to get there to the substances that make up the foods. But what were the foods that were exciting to me that when I took a bite, you know, and I had preferences of some things, but when I took a bite of those foods, my desire for more did not become satisfied. It became amplified. My desire for more became intensified. And even though I would have had preference for an Oreo cookie versus a piece of red licorice, the point was, is both foods, if I dieted from Oreo cookies and I was presented with a red licorice, that's going to do the trick, because I'm chasing an effect that brings me a sense of ease and comfort, even an anticipatory comfort, like even ordering the pizza. It's not even here yet. I haven't even taken a bite of it yet. But even that would slow me down physiologically and bring me a sense of peace and comfort. So I had to start making a list through a food history of what are those foods, with a person in whom the problem has been solved. In other words, someone who's worked through these steps and had a transformation, they can help me with that process. In fact, a tribe of many people that have had that experience can help you. So you build up a tribe of people. And then of course, a nutritionist or a doctor that, here's the caveat, understands the nature of our disease, right? Because if they don't, they might tell you, okay, here's healthy foods, here's unhealthy foods, and you know, we'll put you on a diet, and eventually we will we'll bring those foods back in a moderate amount. That's we'll bring the heroin back in a moderate amount. We don't want that, right? We want to put the foods down entirely, quickly embark on this program of action so that we could cross the bridge to freedom where the obsession is lifted, trusting in the process. You might as well figure it out quickly. If this is a bunch of nonsense, why not figure it out in a couple of months' time? I'm not saying there's a specific amount of time. So back to your question again, how do I figure out the food? Start with the food history. I have heard of the yellow light, red light, green light. I know that for me, broccoli by itself would be a green light. I never had one big, you know, reasonable portion of broccoli. And when I got done, I wanted a bucket of broccoli, right? But maybe you have, I don't know. I never had one apple. I don't care how beautiful the Honeycrisp apple was or what size. And then as soon as I got done, I wanted 20 more apples. And all I could think about is, where can I get myself an apple? And if I drive down the road and I see an apple stand, I would avert my gaze. So because somehow gravitationally my car will be pulled in and I'll start chomping on apples. But maybe you have. So I had to get honest with that. And I needed help from others, you know, to come up with that list. It's a we program. We can't do this alone. So I'd start with that, you know, and then move forward and have the courage, which I know you have the courage to be vulnerable with other people and admit, you know, if there's a food that you're just not sure of, that you're really not sure of, you know, when in doubt, you know, put it down, discuss it with someone else. This evolves over time. We don't figure it out. Yes, it is easier to put down alcohol because alcohol is just, you know, it's either alcoholic or not. Now, I will tell you, for me today, it's either an alcoholic heroin food substance or it isn't. But I understand when we're new, or even new meaning 30 years in program and we've never gone through this exercise, that it's going to be uncomfortable figuring all this out. And that's why we need someone else to hold our hand through this process too. And I'd be happy to help you. And when you hear Jen, I'm sure she'd be happy to help you too. So I hope that helps.
So we have about 6 people who have their hand up and about 20 minutes. So just an idea on time.
Questions are better than anything, right? Yeah.
Okay, great. All right, Deb, you're up. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm asking this question for a listener who can't unmute. So hopefully it will make sense to you. Could you expand on a series of surrender?
Sure. Yeah. Thanks to your friend for the question. I believe that program is a series of surrenders. The first one was I surrendered my pride in walking into the rooms of OA. My first meeting, it was noon, because I figured, what patient of mine is going to be coming to an Overeaters Anonymous at noon in a town 50 miles away? See, I was full of pride and wearing masks and afraid to be vulnerable. And we all come that way to some extent, right? And so I got to that meeting and I sat in my car for quite a while and eventually I had the courage to walk in there. And lo and behold, there was 12 women. Now, women are my greatest teachers. They represent 90% of who's in OA. These are my greatest teachers. And Rose, starting with Roseanne, whom I never knew and, you know, but I've learned from her experience and so many wonderful women that have been my teachers and are still are my teachers. But it was scary for a guy 100 pounds heavier walking into a room of women, some in thin bodies, some in heavy bodies, some who knows. I didn't know what I was doing, but I sure wanted you to, you know, I kept my mouth shut, which is so hard for me. Big shocker, right? But I came in there. And so that was the first surrender. And then over time, the next surrender, which didn't happen right away. In fact, it took a while for me to be beaten into a state of reasonableness by this disease. It was the disease that beat me into a state of reasonableness to get to my second surrender, which was putting the food down. Entire abstinence, determining, am I treating this as a hobby? If it's a hobby, I'll kind of, this is that. It's like playing Scrabble or doing an arts and crafts project for me, which no one would want to see, or singing, which no one would want to hear from me, believe me. It's a hobby, but if I view it as a life and death mission, a way of life, can I get honest and can I get the help of others and find the resources to get clear on what entire abstinence is? There's in November 2020, there are podcasts that you might not even be aware of. There are beautiful teachers, not just big book teachers. I'm not saying that's the be all end all. People that read, you know, and implement, you know, from the instructions in OA literature, AA literature, and all manners of things that are getting well today. They're being separated from their food and they're getting to a place of neutrality. And then they're being able to be of service to others and engage in self-sacrifice with no expectation of a return. That's a change that you won't want to miss. So the second surrender was that. And then each step, my pride, going through a four step, the action steps 4 through 9, the vulnerability, the shame, facing the shame is a series of surrenders, right? And giving it away in step 5. To another person, to God, my higher power, myself and another human being, the exact nature of our wrongs, not just a vague sort of sense of the exact nature of our wrongs. I stole cash from a cash register when I was 23 years of age, the exact nature of our wrongs. See, I kind of told, and then I tell you a little something, and then I tell Jen a little something where it was safe, and then I tell another, but nobody had the entire story. And most people had a very kind of watered down story. I didn't get to the exact, I missed that. You snuck that in the step for me. I didn't read that the first 1,000 times I read the fourth step, you know, fifth step, exact nature of our wrongs. And I didn't have someone to help me. All I knew is what you did to me. That's as far as I got in therapy, who I resented and why. And then I'm gonna go out proving to you to, you know, gain your support on that I was justified in having that resentment. I didn't look at what part of self it affected. There was no resentment prayer, sick person's prayer, as it says in the big book, to do for each person, even if I don't feel it. There was certainly no looking at where was I selfish, dishonest, self-seeking and afraid, because no one helped me. All I saw was the harm you did to me. No one helped me understand that part of my selfishness, even in the worst case scenario, was expecting the world and the people in it to follow Larry's script. That was my selfishness, expecting the world and the people in it to follow my script. If there is a God, if there is a higher power, one thing's for certain, it sure as heck ain't Larry, you know? And that higher power is aware of all, but it was my inventory It told me to put aside entirely what others had done. See, and I wasn't willing to do that. There's, sticking with this question real quickly, there's four barriers to having an effective spiritual awakening. These are important to me. A resentment I will not let go of. Barriers to having a spiritual awakening. A resentment I will not let go of. A secret I will not tell. A secret I will not tell. The third one, an amend I will not make. It's not happening. There's one amend I will not make. And a vicarious thrill that I will not stop. And that vicarious thrill could be manipulation, dishonesty, all manner of different things. It gives me a something, it's an effect that replaced the food. I won't put down that vicarious thrill. And those things kept me from having an effective spiritual awakening. So I'm answering more than was asked, but I hope that helps to illuminate this a little bit.
Thank you.
Sure.
Jen A, you're up.
Hi, thanks so much.
That's my sweetheart.
I was like, I think I better unveil myself or unmask, you know. My name is Jen A. I'm a recovered compulsive overeater. And, you know, Larry, it takes a lot of courage, like you talk about, to come out and speak to a group of people. We talk about speaking truth with a capital T. And that's what I hear. And so I just wanted, not so much to ask you a question, but just to have some commentary on what you've been speaking of and just hearing you say things. And I guess what my higher power is leading me to share right now is my own experience. And my own experience was I came into these rooms because somebody said that a 12-step program might be my only way out of this compulsive disease that I had, eating, anorexia, bulimia, the whole nine yards. Like, it, you know, I suffered greatly. And so I embarked on the journey, right? And I sat in the room like you talk about, and there was this thing called membership. And I had that desire, right? I wish I may, I wish I might not have one more stinking bite. That's what I wished for, right? And the desire was there, and I sat in the rooms and I warmed a chair in Overeaters Anonymous. And like you said, until I was desperate, dying, and doomed to actually start this journey. And I'll never forget, there was a man just like you. He came from Scottsdale, Arizona, and he talked about this practical program of action. And I sat in the front row. And I listened to everything he had to say, and I highlighted it, and I took copious amounts of notes, right? But then I went back home, and I took those notes and the book that he was talking about, and I stuck it on my nightstand. And I didn't take any action because I thought that sitting in the chair, listening to people, having a service position was going to keep me safe and protected. And that's not the story, right? The story is that... when I was dying, desperate and doomed, and I had taken my last bite, and all the wrappers and the things were there in my car, and I'm sitting in that same car right now, right? And the vomit and the toothbrush were there too. And I couldn't stop the behavior. I couldn't stop the eating. What was going to stop a girl like me? Something bigger than myself was going to have to come in. And I love how you so passionately talk about it and share that with people. And I pray that if you're sitting there today and you're questioning and if you're disturbed, be disturbed, right? Because guess what? My greatest disturbance got me to being recovered today by the grace of God, right? And I didn't realize I could be recovered. I didn't know I could be free of the disease and fly. And the butterfly is so beautiful to me today. And your analogy, why? Because I no longer have to sit and suffer in my disease. I no longer have to get on an elliptical three times a day, right? I no longer have to shove my finger down my throat. I no longer have to engage in box after bag of Oreo cookies and milkshakes and drive-thrus. Right? I found freedom. Freedom in what? It started out as a program. It started out as a fellowship, right? And now today, the 12 steps for me are a way of life. And I just thank you so much for continuing to serve and carry a message of depth and weight, because it, you know, if we don't do this, people will die. And here's my biggest reason for knowing this. And this is where it chokes me up. My best friend was found dead on the floor of her home 3 years prior to me finding this program. And seeing somebody else die was not enough for me. You can't experience through somebody else. You have to do it yourself. So I just appreciate everything that you have to say. You know, like you said, you know, if you want to know more about the program of action, take the hand of somebody like Roseanne said. I put your hand in mine and together we will see ... See what? See what happens when you take the hand of a recovered compulsive overeater and actually embark on the work and do this journey, right? And put down the food. I never knew you had to put down the food because I kept eating those other ingredients, those minute things that I thought were okay. And they finally sunk in and tore me up. And when those human emotions built up, the resentment, the fear, the anger, and all of that, then I was ready to do the work. But if you're not ready to do the work, right? I don't know what's going to happen. I didn't want to find out. I didn't want to die. So, yeah, thank you. Thank you for just continuing to do what you do. I love you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I let me just say that that I love you too, Jen. And this is part of program too, you know, where I'll tell you, I can be in a relationship today. And while it's a perfect thing for Jen, right? No, but we can be in a relationship today and be two imperfect human beings and try to carry a message of depth and weight and embrace our imperfections as human beings. But at the same time, this stuff works. And yes, it's a deadly disease. And yes, I stole that butterfly metaphor from Jen. Of course I did. I steal good things from good people, you know, and then I put my own little twist on it. But we're encouraged to do that. So if that stuck out for you, Jen's garage code is 5555. She's in Littleton, Colorado. No. Thank you, Jen. Appreciate it. Is there other
we have questions? Two more questions. And then just to give you a heads up, we have about 5 more minutes. Okay, so
sure.
Jan and then Phyllis. Go ahead, Jan.
Hi, I'm Jan. And I just wanted to say thank you so much because you actually addressed a lot of my confusion in the program, especially when I first came in. And kind of sometimes depression about the program of watching people that I could, it took me a while to find the recovery people. And so I think to put my eyes on the recovered and follow that path is important. And another thing that you said that helped a lot was that thing about take what you want and leave the rest was so off-putting for me and confusing for me when I came into the program, because hadn't I spent my life taking what I wanted and leaving the rest? Mm-hmm. I needed to take what I needed, not what I wanted. So thanks for clearing a lot of that up for me, and I appreciate it so much.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for your comments on that.
Thank you, Jan. Phyllis.
Yes, I want to thank you so much for your share, Larry. I really appreciate it. Next month, I will be in the program 45 years. And so you can tell by my gray hair that I'm just 49 years old. I spent a lot of years in the program of going through the steps and being successful for short periods of time. One time I had a whole year, and then not succeeding for another period of time. And it always went back to my baking. And I found that it was when I needed love. And baking was always love for me because I had 7 children. And of course, when they smelled the baking, oh, mom, you know, and hugs and loves and kisses and everything. And so I don't know what turned the corner for me,